Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Maple in the middle this morning. We'll learn about the Proctor Maple Research Center, and we'll visit the Sugar House at Silloway Maple in Randolph. We're going to finish the show getting ready for planting season, meeting the folks at High Mowing Organic Seeds. But we get things started this morning with our continuing celebration of WDEV's 90th anniversary. That has included our tour of towns throughout our listening area. And our next stop will be next Thursday morning when we tuck into the Hastings store at Joe's Pond, getting ready for ice out. The other part of the 90th birthday celebration is spending time with our WDEV All-Stars. And this morning, that All-Star is WDEV General Manager Steve Cormier. Corm, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
Listeners, if you've got a question for Corm, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I like you as a guest. You didn't try to read the questions I have for you. You're ready for anything now.
I did no prep for this.
Perfect. So you were born and raised in Massachusetts. Where was that?
Fitchburg.
And what was growing up like that there?
It was great. You know, I was the youngest of four. I had two brothers and an older sister, and my sister was not happy when I was born because here's another boy in the family.
Oh, yeah.
But I really give credit to my friends, to who I became, because I had a great group of friends, and all we did from sunrise to sunset was street hockey, wiffle ball, football.
Right.
I mean, we were playing sports all the time. We'd capture the flag. Yeah. And that was my upbringing, and I really never got into – I was the angel of the family. My two brothers – I can't count on both hands how many times my brother Ray got brought home by the cops or something. But, yeah, so I was the angel of – my sister, really the angel,
yeah.
My sister Jean.
Yeah. But as far as the boys, a pretty low bar.
Yeah, and I passed it, I guess. Yeah, but, first 23, 24 years of my life was spent there, and very happy I got out of there.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, I mean, they have a state college, but you decided not to go there, right? You went to Linden State.
I went to a community college for a year, Mount Wachusett, and they had a broadcasting program there. And after about a year, I really wasn't a student. I wasn't. And I ended up working in a tuxedo shop measuring inseams. Oh. I joke about that. I don't think they have a Hall of Fame for measuring inseams. But, you know, along the way, I was dating somebody who was going to college. And I said, well, what am I doing here? You know, there's got to be something better for me. And I started looking around. And I looked in this book. And I said, Linden State, where the heck is this thing? It's up in Vermont. Well, let's go visit it. So I went to UVM in the morning. And left there and said, this is way too big for me, and went to Linden. And within 20 minutes, I knew this was my place.
Isn't
when I walked across that library roof and I saw the ice penis sculpture, and anybody that went to Linden knows what I'm talking about, and that is what it's called. I said, this is the place for me.
Well, that tells us enough about his motivations. What did you major in broadcasting there then, or –
Communication Arts and Sciences.
Okay.
Yeah, and great faculty, probably my best friends still to this day. I am close with many of those guys.
Well, I know you're a very proud alum, no matter what name it goes by, but what is it about the school that made it the right place for you?
It wasn't a huge college. I think there was about 1,200 students, commuters as well.
Wow.
But it was the relationship with the professors. They cared. They really did. I mean, there's a couple professors that I'm still in touch with. Cindy Baldwin took 2 years of voice and diction to get rid of that Massachusetts accent that every once in a while comes back.
Sure.
Russ Bayless was my advisor, and he would kick my butt every once in a while, and I needed that. Mike Thurston from Exile on Main Street,
one
of my professors.
No kidding.
But it was just that relationship you had with your professors that still takes place today, because two of my other sons went there. And that is still happening, that small school feeling where you can get a really great education and you can walk out of there and say, that guy's my friend. He wasn't just my teacher.
Yeah.
He's my friend. So it just goes through the decades. It's still sort of the same, Harvard on the Hill.
Harvard on the Hill. It is interesting how, you know, we're young, we're coming out of high school or making choices in high school. We really don't know what we're doing, you know, and we're trying to plot our entire life. And you wind up, I did it at University of Dayton, you step on the campus and say, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be. And 4 years later, you knew you were right somehow. And you did that at Linden.
I always knew I wanted to be in broadcasting. I worked for my cable company back in Fitchburg calling hockey, New England Junior Hockey League action, the Fitchburg Wallace Wallopers at the Wallace Civic Center. So I used to call hockey and football. And when I got to Linden, I got heavily involved with the college radio station. My friends Rick Adams and Chuck Lewis kind of brought me into that. They're still great friends of mine today. Mm-hmm. Was the GM, the PD, and loved it. Knew that's what I wanted to do. I did television for one summer up there and covered a plane crash. And when I got on site, the two people were still in the plane.
Oh, my.
And they were dead, unfortunately. And I said to myself, is this what you really want to do? No. I want to be me. I want to have fun. And radio was where I went.
Wow. The Wallace Wallopers, though. Do you remember who the top player was on the Wallace Wallopers?
No clue. Absolutely no clue. I think Matt – is it Matt Snyder? He used to live in Colchester and played for the Canadians.
I think
he and his brother played for them at one point, but that was past my days.
Oh, all right. And do you remember, you know, when you started doing radio, do you have any idea what the first song was you ever played as a DJ?
I don't, but I do remember the very first night I was on the air when in commercial radio. It was M106 in Claremont, New Hampshire. It's now called Q106, I believe. And I had to play this disc. It was called Interview, and it was Pat Benatar. It was a one-hour special. And I started up, and I'm thinking, this is great, man. This, I'm wrapping up my first night on the air. And what I realized is halfway through the program is I played the second half first. And I didn't get fired, so I figured, okay, you made your mistake. But I don't remember the first song I played. That's a great question.
Yeah, I don't either. You know, but I know DJs who do. It's like, how did you know? I was so frightened, you know. I was following somebody else. They left and said, okay, you're on. And it's like, what do I do now? Good thing, you know, I think if the interview with Pat Benatar had started to skip and you didn't catch it, that would have got you fired right away. But as long as you got the whole thing played and filled the hour, did all right.
Nobody called.
Yeah. So graduating from Linden, did you go right into radio?
Yeah, so Claremont, New Hampshire, WECM was my first job. I was called the ugliest man in radio, which Joe Benning, State Senator Joe Benning, and another guy at Linden, Joe Romano, came up with that nickname for me in college. And I kept it. It was my first job. And I had T-shirts made up, Rick, that said, Wake Up Ugly. So when I got to Hartford, Connecticut, the PD said, nah, we're not going to use that name.
You're not going to believe this, but we now have, quite frankly, in the dump studio, the two ugliest men in radio. When I went to the University of Dayton, I was the three-time, and I retired undefeated. They didn't have it my senior year. I was the ugliest man on campus 3 years in a row. Freshman year, they had it, a sorority had it to raise money. And these two guys on my floor came running up to the floor and said, we told them you'd do it. We told them you'd do it. Run for ugly man on campus. I don't know if it was a compliment or not, but you won a trophy and a keg of beer. And so, of course, I did it and won.
I got a job.
So, there you go. So we can vote on who's even uglier. I'm going to say me, but that's because you're the boss. All right. And did you, other than the ugliest man in radio, any other like faux names or silly names that you had to use on the air?
Not really. When I got to Hartford, it was WCCC, and I just missed Howard Stern there by a couple of years. He worked there.
Wow.
And left over a $50 a week raise because the owner of the station was by far the cheapest person on the planet. and so I was there for a couple of years, and then I ended up in Burlington in 86 at WIZN. It's funny that, you know, I worked for a lot of different program directors, and it's not just the good ones you learn from, but the bad ones.
Yeah.
And there were a couple during that time that I said to myself, I'd never do that. And it was a great lesson going to Hartford. Couldn't wait to get out, though.
How long were you at WCCC? Sounds like the Civil Conservation Corps. Really.
Yeah, 2.5 years. Actually, it has to do with cut clarity and consistency. It had to do with a jeweler bought it. That's how we came up with the call letters. Yeah, so 2.5 years. The best part about that is my son was born in Hartford. Nice. And we all got out alive back in 86.
Did you have the Whalers down there at the time or not?
No.
They might not have been there yet.
But what's funny is, and maybe they did. I can't remember. But I actually got to play in a celebrity hockey game with Gordie Howe. Oh,
okay.
And I was the only one on the ice wearing sneakers because I couldn't skate. And Gordie Howe's kind of looking at me like, what's this guy doing?
Good thing he didn't take a run at you. He was a hard man. All right. Let's take a call before we go to a break. We got Brian joining us from Eden. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing? Corn.
Good. Yes.
So good to hear you on the air.
Thank you.
Your stories are amazing. I wanted to run by. I've been calling a lot lately because I used to be all involved in radio. And then for 30 years, it conflicted with my work schedule. So you can tell, Rick, I call almost as much as Fred at this point.
Well, no, nobody's getting close to Fred. But.
I think the first time I met you was probably over at Mike Calhoun's place in Virgin's in IZN land. And yes. It was just such a, you know, it wasn't like we were bad people, but we were wild. And like Jeff Nicholson, Andy Potter, and just looking at the past and just what a great crew that was. And I was involved with DEV quite a bit back then. But my favorite thing, when I heard you were taking on the, you know, Radio Vermont group, it just made me so happy because, you know, DEV is not your typical place. It's more like dealing with a force of nature or something.
Yeah.
But it is a radio station. And my favorite thing about what you're doing is not just looking back, but looking ahead. I love that piece when you, you have the old squire, then you have Ken, and then you come on.
Yeah.
And just like people like Rick, Greg, Brady, like just, you know, just looking ahead. And it's just, you know, there aren't many people who would have the skills to do what you can do, not just maintain, but improve, you know. And I'm just so heartened that you're there. I just wanted to give you a shout out.
Well, all thanks. Right. Thanks, Brian. Brian. I do like that, you know, there, he does, delineate between wild and bad. You can be wild and not necessarily bad. And we all had those wild younger days.
Mike Calhoun, we used to call that place the Radio Ranch. And I give credit to Mike for me coming to Burlington. He's the guy that, made that happen at IZN. And unfortunately, we lost him last year. But he was a great guy and a lot of fun to work with. And that with that crew back then, we weren't just people that walked into our radio station. We were friends. We did a lot of things together.
Yeah. So let's head to Newbury and talk to Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Steve, remember the telephone call we had years ago?
About your cell phone coverage?
Yeah.
Did you put a cell tower on your house, Fred, because your cell service seems to work now?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I did. This program is probably my favorite program because it's so eclectic. And I thought that you were getting a little carried away there when you restricted me to 2 days a week. So I said, you can't do that. So I kept calling, and finally you gave in. And I'm glad you did.
Well, I just restricted you to 1 day a week, Fred, but thanks for the call.
Fred, the other thing that helps is once you became a Duke, yes, you know, you got royal privilege.
That's it, Fred.
Duke You're without Duke portfolio. All right. Thanks for the call, Fred. So one of the places you landed was on the show, the Corman the Coach show.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you bums, the only time I've ever been close to an award, I finished second to you guys in the 7 Days Daisy Awards for Best DJ. You guys won. Thanks very much. But that was a great combination. How did that happen? How long did you two yuck it up together for?
You know, back in the early days, there was a guy by the name of Steve McGray, our general manager, and he came back one day and said, I just saw this guy at a Rotary dinner, and he spoke, and he was just so – you were on listening to every word he had to say, and he was hilarious. And I just think someone like that would make so much sense on radio because he would transcend the music. Wouldn't matter what you played, people would want to listen. And Rich Haskell was doing the morning show at that point. So we set something up with Tom where he would call in after a home game with Rich and Nancy Messino. And then the season ended, and we were in Virgin, so it just kind of went away. Well, about 4 months later, I started taking over the morning show because of Dave McAvern at Heritage, went to our general manager and said, you got to have Corm on the morning show. You just got to have him on. So I started doing it. About a month into it, I said, I wonder if that guy Brennan is interested. And I called him. And I just said, hey, you still interested in doing some radio? And he said, yeah. I said, well, come on down. Let's meet. And he came down, and we met, and we started the show on a Tuesday. And by Wednesday, I was calling Corm and the coach. The chemistry between Tom and I, and we really – I'd met him one time. But the chemistry between the two of us was amazing. And it still is, even when we host the show every once in a while on our sister station. And the characters that we brought in, my boy Bill Corbeil, who passed away about 11 years ago, we called him the Rocker, and Rye Guy, and all these characters, Ian Kelly, they all were a part of this family. And I tell you what, I would walk out of there at 9 o'clock in the morning with a headache every morning, Rick, from laughing. I'm not kidding you. I love Tom Brennan. He's a great friend and just – a guy who gives back to the community beyond what people know, honestly.
And it is difficult doing that morning show, getting up that early. And if it's not fun, if it's not interesting, boy, that can be the worst job in the world. But when it's great, you know, it's heady. It's just
it's crazy.
Great thing to be involved with.
Yeah. I remember walking into the Champions one night. We got out of a limo, and you would have thought we were the astronauts that just landed on the moon. It was that crazy. And I just said, regular people having fun, but people loved us, and we really had a great time together.
Yeah. So what brought you here to WDEV?
Well, I was in Brattleboro for a couple of years helping a friend out down there. My friend Bill Corbeil and his wife Kelly had bought a station down there, and Bill passed away. So I moved down there for a couple of years to help Kelly out, and finally just said, you don't need my help anymore. You've got this, you know, even though you didn't start in radio, you got this. But, you know, Mike, you can call me anytime. I'll come down when you need my help. But and Amy McGovern, who worked here, who I hired out of college, and who passed away a couple of years ago in a tragic motorcycle accident, told me, hey, there's a job opening as a sales manager. And I'm like, that's not my thing. I'm not a sales guy. But, hey, I'm moving back to Chittenden County because my wife's there. I'll apply. And I applied, and Eric Michaels hired me. And I was shocked. Because once again, you want me to be a sales manager. But, you know, anybody that knows this place knows it's not just one job. You do multiple jobs here,
indeed.
And that's just the way it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so tell people, you know, about the different hats you wear. What a general manager of the Radio Vermont Group, not just DEV, but LVB and CVT, you know, what does that entail?
Your fingers are in every part of this place, and it changes every day. You know, people will say, what is your legacy? My legacy will always be Corman the coach, but the most important job I'll ever have is this place. Yeah. Been here almost 7 years. The legacy of this place, the Squires, whether it's Lloyd or Ken, 86, 87 years of ownership, and trying to respect that legacy and move it forward, as Brian was saying, is crucial because radio changes and all the stuff in the background, the digital stuff we do, the podcast, the website, the Facebook page, it's all another way of communicating and getting the message out. So, you know, I have a list every day I come in here, Rick, and things get added to the list. So I am lucky I have a great staff. Yeah. Let me just say that because there's no way I could do what I do here without other people helping. So I do feel blessed in that way.
A couple of weeks ago, you took a week off. You came back, said, hey, how was the week off? And you rolled your eyes because he was not going to be like accessible. No emails. We had emails from him every single day. And it was kind of like you were working, but just not in the building for that entire week.
That was a crazy week, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like everything wanted to go wrong every day while I was on vacation, but thank God I love what I do. I will say that.
Yeah. If someone is interested in getting into radio, maybe even working at WDEV, what would you recommend they do to get started?
I know there's community radio stations out there, but you got to find a way to get in the door. You know, the thing about internships, and I have a young woman from Linden now interning here, Alexander Huff, you get in the door and you see what it's like. You see what's going on and you figure out if that's something you want to do. I mean, doing television that summer at Linden made me realize what I wanted to do. Yeah. I mean, I was getting paid for it. But you have to find a way to get in the building and just spend time there and talk to people. And that's really it. The more involved you get, the better the chance you can live this dream, because it has been a dream for me.
Yeah. Well, the two of us have been in radio long enough to have heard the death knell sound for terrestrial radio several times. Big radio companies, the internet, Sirius, podcasts, you know, all of them were the wave of the future, and this kind of a station was obsolete, was going to die, and it's now 90 years. So what is it that allows a station like WDEV to survive?
We're relevant every day, every hour, and you have to be that way. You've got to be local. I know people overplay that, but, you know, 7 or 8 hours of local news every day, 3-4 hours of local talk every day, high school basketball. I mean, I joke with Brent Curtis, this is the most wonderful time of the year because of high school basketball, Red Sox baseball, Norwich hockey. You combine all of these things that we do, and we continue to add to the podcast, the website, Facebook, all that other stuff. It keeps us relevant, and people want to know what's going on in their community. There is no other radio station like this in the Northeast. Jeff Spalding said it. You are the most relevant radio station, the most important radio station in New England.
Wow.
And I think we have to live that every day as a crew. And I, once again, Lee Cattell's been here 20 years. He will be a Hall of Famer. There is no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
Kaya Como, another one of those people who stepped up and took over news for us in the morning.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. I mean, all you got to do is say, hey, can you help? Boom. There they are.
Yeah.
So we got to stay relevant. We got to continue to serve this community and listen to people.
Yeah. Got about 30 seconds left, but you have three sons. One, I think, just one, is making a career out of radio. Did you not warn him off of the dangers of this occupation?
Long hours, little pay. But he signed up. And
sounds
he's
doing, so alluring, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's doing afternoons at our station up at WLVB in Morrisville, and he calls himself Corm as well, and he and his dad both have the same voice, except I have a good mustache and he's got a head of hair.
And props to him, Peter. He actually directed the show when I started on Vermont Viewpoint, so did a really fine job. Steve Cormier is the general manager of WDEV, WLVB, and WCVT, and that keeps him plenty busy. Corm, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for saying yes to taking the job, by the way.
We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll return to celebrate another Vermont anniversary, this one for the Proctor Maple Research Center. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's 3 full hours of the Getaway with the G-Man, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I've always said that there's something special about the terra firma here in Vermont, and I'm pretty sure that the longer you're here, the more you can feel the subtle changes in what's happening around you, such as this week, you can feel that the sap is starting to flow. It also helps to look for the telltale signs like the smoke and steam rising from sugar houses all over the state and the excitement you hear in the voices of your friends who have a sugar bush, large or small. One organization that has been tracking the changes, large and small, in sugar making has been UVM's Proctor Maple Research Center, now celebrating its 75th anniversary. Here to share the history of the center and some of what has been learned in those 75 years is Mark Isselhart, host of the Vermont Maple Minute. Mark, great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question about sugaring for Mark or you want to let us know if you're boiling yet, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, what is the Proctor Maple Research Center?
Well, the Proctor Maple Research Center is a field station held within the plant biology department, formerly known as the botany department, and it's all within the College of Ag and Life Science at the University of Vermont. So a lot of mouthful there, but it's essentially it's a location that is of a scale large enough and with facilities and trees great enough to be able to do ongoing research. Maple had been studied at UVM long before the Proctor Center was founded. Back in the late 1800s, there was some really interesting work being done on campus looking at these basic questions about sap flow, sap sweetness, how to make good quality syrup. But they were usually done either on campus with campus trees or with nearby sugar houses. Back then there were sugar houses nearby campus. But then there was a growing feeling that there needed to be a permanent location somewhere. And through the determination of Dr. Jim Marvin and Dr. Fred Taylor, who were the original researchers and others, and through the generous donation of land from Governor Mortimer Proctor, the old Harvey Farm in Underhill Center was purchased and donated to the university.
Well, tell us about that property, how big it is, what's there, how many, I know you tap the trees there, so how many taps you've got going?
Sure. So the Harvey Farm, when UVM took ownership, was a kind of a classic Vermont hill farm. There was fields that were starting to become reverting to forest. There was some open land, but there's also sort of a classic northern hardwoods mix. You have sugar maple, American beech, yellow birch. It is on the western side of Mansfield, just below where it really starts to get steep. But we're up around 1,300 feet, go a little higher than that, and we start to see some conifers start to creep in because we are getting higher and higher in elevation. Right now, we're about 225 acres. The original donation was a little smaller, but we have acquired some neighboring land as the research has demanded more space. And, there isn't anything, it's not a particularly ideal site for growing sugar maple. It's really kind of middle of the road, I would say. But there was sugaring going on at the location in the past, but it wasn't until the very modest first lab was brought up on skis. It looks more like an ice fishing shanty than a scientific laboratory. But Drs. Marvin and Taylor did some really interesting work right from the get-go, trying to understand this kind of fascinating process of sap flow and why certain trees are sweeter than others, and all these kind of questions that really need careful observation to get good data.
Mark, we probably take it for granted here in Vermont that, we have a maple research center, but are there any others like it in the country or in the world?
Yeah, so the Cornell University has a few field stations. There's the Eline Station, which is in Lake Placid, and then there's the Arnott Forest, which is closer to the main Cornell campus, and they've been doing research and similar projects for a long time. I don't know off the top of my head when those were founded, but I think I can be pretty comfortable saying that the UVM facility is the preeminent facility in the U.S., and we've been doing it, the longest.
Yeah, 75 years. And then, Mark, you are a maple specialist for UVM Extension. So what is the connection between the Proctor Maple Research Center and UVM Extension?
So 75 years ago, when it was founded, people understood that to do research in a vacuum would not benefit the maple industry. It might have and does have good basic scientific value, but there was always a desire to go beyond just basic academic understanding and end up having more applied research as well. And so from maybe the year after or a little after that, they built a sugar house, a new sugar house, and immediately got into the business of producing syrup at a scale that's relevant to the industry. Back then, it would have been buckets and all wood, no reverse osmosis. And that applied research and that ability to take academic research findings and put it in a form that's usable for either agricultural producers or whoever, that's at the heart of what Extension does. Extension itself is over 100 years old, and the founding tenets of that program is to make sure that information that's shared with producers doesn't come from a commercial necessarily background, but really more research-based, and trying to give producers the best information possible.
You mentioned a few things, but what type of research does the center do?
Right. And, you know, it's amazing how something can be studied for over 100 years and we're still at it. But
yeah.
Maple is unique. You know, the sugaring season itself is only 6 to 8 weeks long. And by default, that means our research window is quite small, too. We're also talking about these hardy perennial plants, red and sugar maple trees that live for a long time. So it's not like we're doing field trials like corn or some other annual crop. So you have to, every year is different, and so when we want to know why does one tree sweeter than the other, or can you propagate a sweet tree, can you understand what the best mechanism for collecting sap is, all those things were questions right out of the gate that they did at the Proctor Maple Research, and actually back then it was called the Proctor Maple Research Farm. And we're at it today. We've learned a great deal. We really understand a lot more than we did, but there is still a little bit of mystery about, you know, driving the system and how to optimize yields in a sustainable way. So the mission today has 3 points. It's research, it's demonstration, and education. And we tap about 6,000 trees. Every one of those taps is in some form of research. It could be a small collection of trees and more of a pilot study, or it could be a larger study looking at something like what are the long-term effects of modern high vacuum sap extraction compared to more traditional levels. So it really depends on what the scientific inquiry is. It depends on what the industry is asking for. But it's a pretty fascinating place. I've been very lucky to be there for a long time. And we were lucky enough to showcase it yesterday as the Governor Scott came and did the governor's tree tapping at our facility. And I found this clipping, Rick, that was from 1947. And then Governor Ernest Gibson visited the Proctor Center. And it was right after the center was founded. And they talked about a lot of the same things, making high-quality syrup. And they even had back then in 47, they had a power tapping machine on display, which we still have. It's a backpack gas-powered. it's got a flexible PTO coming off. I don't know. The safety features are a little questionable. But
you didn't make Governor Scott use that yesterday when he tapped the first tree, did you?
No. It was a cordless drill, nice 18-volt, ready to. No gas involved.
Good. Does the governor sugar at home? Do you know?
Not to my knowledge. I think he's quite busy.
Yeah.
But
right.
It's a lot of work. So I maybe someday. But
yeah. And Mark, is there anything special happening tied to the 75th anniversary this year at the Proctor Center?
Yeah, so we are. We had a really wonderful video produced by the folks at Across the Fence. I'd point people to it if they wanted to go to the Extension Maple page. Just search for UVM Extension Maple. We put a link to that right at the you land right there, and you can see the video. And that really highlights some of the history of it. We found some great footage, some old film footage from the early '60s of some experimental tubing and. You can watch that video. We have the tree tapping. We're going to be doing a sugar on snow party on campus, which is a longstanding tradition, and we're hoping COVID will allow us to do that again this spring. And then there'll be a larger event probably later in the summer, and we're hoping to throw a bit of a birthday party for the Proctor Center.
Nice. Mark, how does the Proctor Center help maple syrup producers?
Sure. So the industry has evolved dramatically from the days of a pretty crude wound on the tree, collecting in some sort of container, all the way up through what we see today is modern high vacuum tubing and high sugar concentration RO. Those innovations have been, in a way, a partnership between the industry, the manufacturers, and research. And you know, you can make the argument that it doesn't matter how fast and how efficient your operation is. If the quality of the syrup doesn't meet the standards, then it's not really valuable. So we will oftentimes have experiments that look at how modern technology works, but then also look at what's the impact to either the resource, the trees, or maybe the other end of the process, the finished syrup. So, for example, we've had experiments looking at what's the impact of high vacuum on the internal staining that a tree normally produces. It's a normal process. The tree combines sort of its wood anatomy and some active production of defensive chemicals to prevent huge infection. We did experiments looking at, okay, how big is that internal staining when no vacuum is applied compared to maybe modest levels or really high levels? And you can imagine, you know, we don't have the ability of x-ray vision, so we have to actually apply those treatments and then cut the trees down and carefully measure the internal staining. And, you know, we find that, in fact, there are no differences. The staining is the same size and internally, even at relatively high levels of vacuum. You know, the industry doesn't have the benefit of having, you know, they have different priorities. They need to promote the products, produce good quality syrup, market it. Research is really there to ask those questions, carefully gather those results, and then discuss those and share them with the industry. So, like I said early on, the Proctor Center is interested in basic science. We all, you know, it's always the foundation of the stuff we do, but there's always an applied component so that it's relevant to the industry. So the internal wounding is one. Very early on in, you know, maybe about 10 years after the Proctor Center was started, as a result of some of the innovations after World War II, plastic became more mass-produced and affordable, and then you started to see the advent of plastic tubing. And in fact, plastic tubing wasn't invented to boost yield per tap per se. It was really just to reduce the labor needed to go and get the sap from the tree to some collection point. Some of the early recommendations from, you know, people in my position were just roll out the tubing on the ground, and as long as it's going downhill, it should be fine. And I think if anyone saw that today in the woods, you'd think that, you know, there was a problem. But the technology changes, the understanding changes as the data comes in. And so the tubing was a big one. Another really key figure in the Proctor Center's history is Dr. Maria Franca Morselli. She was really a fascinating person. I was lucky to meet her a little bit when I was first starting my career. She was a microbiologist by training and just a really gifted scientist and also a passionate advocate for Vermont and Vermont maple. And she brought a really interesting perspective on things about how to maintain high-quality syrup by understanding the microbiology impacting sap and also syrup. And so she did some really interesting work trying to help producers make the highest value product possible and not lose value as a result of poor tapping practices or poor sanitation in the production. She's also featured in that video I mentioned about the 75th.
It is
really a fascinating person.
Yeah. Has the Proctor Research Center looked at how the sugaring season has shifted due to climate change?
Yeah, for sure. The director of the Proctor Center, Tim Perkins, he has done probably the most extensive research on that. And it's like a lot of things in maple, gathering careful data is challenging because to answer that question, you can't just randomly ask people, how's your season going? When did you start? When did you finish? Because over time, people's production practices change. And so that can kind of muddy the waters and you lose that ability to see just the signal of if there is a shift in the season. By gathering and getting good data from producers, not just in Vermont, but in other places, he was able to see that the season is starting earlier. The trend is definitely earlier. The ending point is earlier. And overall, the duration from start to finish has been contracting maybe about 10% over the last 60 years. What's interesting, though, is that we haven't seen a 10% contraction in production. If anything, we've seen an explosion in production. And yields actually are going up as well. And a lot of that, I think, can be explained by more modern tapping practices, using high vacuum, things that kind of allow producers to maximize how much sap they get out when the sap is running. If you were using buckets and tapping in a more traditional way, you would probably see bigger losses than if you were following more the weather instead of the calendar. And that's information that has come out of this, you know, the Proctor Maple Research Center for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I don't think there's any scientific data on this, but I'm not sure I've ever met people who love their jobs more, whether it's their main business or a side business, than sugar makers. First of all, would you agree, and why is that?
Yeah, no, I think the up and down the line, doesn't matter the scale, if you're just a few trees as a hobby with a family, or, you know, tens of thousands of taps, maple is this, you know, iconic non-timber forest product. It captivates the imagination because it is, it's in the woods, it's mysterious. The weather is so critical, even in, you know, 2022, weather is so critical as far as whether or not the sap will run or not. And although we have a lot of knowledge, we've gained a lot of understanding, there's still some things we don't understand. The other thing is that, you know, it's a great product. You know, at the end of the day, it's delicious, and people have a lot of pride and put a lot of hard work into making this product that has such a rich history in Vermont. And people love being part of it. I love being part of it. And there's no shortage of inventiveness and resourcefulness from sugar makers. You have to have so many different skills, plumber and forester and, you know, everything, weather forecaster, all those skills go into making this product successfully.
Mark Isselhart is the host of the Vermont Maple Minute and is a UVM Extension Maple Specialist. To learn more about the Proctor Maple Research Center, you can go to uvm.edu. Mark, great having you on the show again. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. And good luck to all those sugar makers out there.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break for top of the hour CBS News, and then we're going to head to one of those sugar makers, heading to Silloway Maple Sugar House in Randolph next. And as a reminder that coming up this morning at 11, it's Common Sense Radio. That is followed today by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference at noon. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Last week at the Elmore store, I taught a recent transplant to Vermont the ratio, you know, 40 to 1, 40 gallons of sap to 1 gallon of syrup. When he's ready for the graduate course, we'll discuss what percentage of sugar the sap must be. I love the math of sugar making, but those who actually make syrup probably have so many other things that they love about it. And we are now heading to a sugar house in Randolph, checking in with Silloway Maple. Joining me is Betty and Marilyn Lambert. Good morning. How are y'all?
Good morning. We're fine, thanks.
You duet. I like that. All right. We're going to give a tip of the cap to Charlie Taplin, by the way, of the Floating Bridge Family Farm, for suggesting that we check in with Silloway Maple. And listeners, to ask a question about their maple operation, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Before we go into the history, Marilyn, how are things going there? What's happening at Silloway Maple right now?
Well, things are going well. We have some cold weather today, so it's mostly the sap's all frozen up, but we've made 1,100 gallons so far, so we're off to a good start, we think. It's been really windy, so that impacted the guys fixing lines out in the woods and kind of put a stop on the sap flow on days we thought it might run otherwise, but we're hopeful for a good season.
Excellent. Has to be better than last year. We had a bit of a down one last year. Betty, tell us about your parents, Paul and Louise Silloway.
Yes, they came here as newlyweds in the 1940s, bought a very run-down dairy farm, and, of course, with dairy farm management, maple goes hand-in-hand because with the fields, we often tell tourists who don't know much about Vermont, you get the steep, ledgy, wild maple trees. Sometimes people wonder if we plant all our trees, but we don't have to. Mm-hmm. So my parents started. My dad did all his farm work and sugaring with a team of workhorses. And then as the years went by, you know, moved along to gathering from buckets with a bulldozer. And I had a very old small sugar house at the original farm, built a new one in 1958. And then my son built this sugar house in, well, I don't know what year, maybe 2013. So maybe 10 years ago, expanded a lot. We went from producing an average of 500 gallons a year to 3,500, and then a big leap. Now we hope to produce 12,000 gallons.
Wow, that's outstanding. And when did, at what point in the operation did you switch to tubing and then from gravity to vacuum?
Yeah, in 1978 we switched to tubing mostly, but it was still on gravity. And wow, in those days we had so much trouble with squirrel damage. We tried taking the tubing down every year and putting it in barrels and thought we knew our trees so one by one, it would be easy to reinstall it, but no. And we never got a really good mapping, marking system for re-putting up the tubing. It was always a challenge, and we have less squirrel damage nowadays. I can't tell you what year we started with vacuum.
12 years ago?
Maybe 12 years ago, but I have a feeling it was longer than that.
Yeah, it goes by pretty quickly. And Marilyn, how many trees are you tapping there at Silloway?
So we are up to close to about 25,200 trees, I think it is.
That's incredible. And it, I mean, the logistics of that must be staggering. So, you know, when do you get started? You know, tapping for the season?
Sure. Well, my brother Paul Lambert is a stellar manager. So he really has the production management end down to a science. This year we started tapping on January 19th. Historically, we always did, you know, on school vacation week in February.
Right.
So the kids could participate in that. But now, you know, we have to start a little earlier to get all our trees tapped in time for a possible first run, which we succeeded in this year. So January 19th, we've been tapping since then.
Outstanding. Now, Betty, yep. It's come a long way since you were there early on. Didn't the kids kind of have each an individual job as you went out and tapped and hung the buckets?
Yeah, my dad always did all the tapping, and then the heavy job, that was the smart job, knowing, and it still is, knowing, you know, just where to put a new hole and stay away from the old ones and so on. The heavy job was usually, when I was young, my brother David, he carried a whole roll of sap buckets through the woods to hang, and if anyone's ever felt a sting in the palm of their hand, it would be trying to smack those buckets apart because they would stick together in the roll.
Right.
Then often the next person, one of us younger ones, would put on a cover, and I guess I skipped the second man. That would be the person with a carpenter's apron full of spouts, and they would have been tapping them in. Usually when I was growing up, my brother Stuart would be doing that. So, yeah, we each had a job, and then during sugaring, my dad always did all the boiling, and the rest of us were busy gathering the sap. We usually had two rigs going with a tractor or bulldozer and a sap tank through the woods.
Do you miss?
I was the smallest, so I usually ran the bulldozer because I wasn't big enough to lift the sap.
That's a good job. Betty, do you miss those days with all the tubing now? Do you? Would you like it to go back to that kind of operation?
Well, it's a real business now. Wow. In those days, it was more of a sideline to the dairy. And I wouldn't like to go back as far as income and size go. We could never gather all these taps with buckets. But the camaraderie and the fun with my family gathering sap in rainstorms and windstorms and snowstorms and in hot sun, you just couldn't beat it. That was a very, very special time of growing up.
Lovely memories. Marilyn, it seems as if the farm operation, has really become quite sustainable. And let's talk about the solar array that you have there at Silloway.
Well, I'm not a solar professional, so I can't give you all the ins and outs of numbers. But off the top of my head, we had Integrity Energy from Bethel, Vermont, install that solar system, and we could not be, they also did one for the Silloway Dairy Farm as well, and we could not be more happy with, you know, their professionalism. If we have a problem, they come right out and fix it. It, our solar array, I can't tell you, again, the kilowatt size of it off the top of my head, but it does supply all of the power this time of year to run our reverse osmosis machine, power, you know, the fan on the evaporator and all the electricity that we have. During the summer, we definitely produce more electricity than we need. We don't have a battery backup system, so that, you know, electricity just goes back on the grid and we get credit for it that we can draw from this time of year. So as far as being, you know, electricity, we are completely powered by the sun, which, you know, makes us pretty thrilled.
Yeah. And then it's a wood-fired sugar house. So where does the wood come from, Marilyn?
So my brother, Paul, that's probably the diversified aspect of our sugaring business. But during the summertime, he cuts and sells, you know, almost 1,000 cords of firewood. He also has an excavation business that he runs as well and does some log jobs. So the sugar wood can come, you know, from, he cuts down trees for people and brings them home. He does a log job and we, you know, burn the red pine tops, or, you know, he's just making firewood and some of it's a little too gnarly to send to his customers. So he stacks it out front in these beautiful beehive Holzhausen German wood stacks that, you know, then get us through the sugaring season.
Yeah, let's talk about the way he stacks the wood. Who's the expert on that? Betty, do you know about this Holzhausen wood stacking? I understand it is really helpful in drying the wood.
Well, it is, and for us, it's also a great curiosity and beautiful point for our tourists to see. We have a lot of tourists here, and it's just really neat. We've had quite a few years of this way of wood stacking now, and to see them out front, they are like a giant beehive.
Yeah.
You start one, Paul's the expert, I guess you asked that. So he's the expert on the thought behind this way of stacking wood, but it's vertical instead of horizontal, so it takes less space, but it's just really neat to look at. And you start one by driving a pin in the ground and having a rope go out, drawing that circumference and stacking the wood, you know, circular, going in a little bit as you go up.
Amazing.
And I think it's particularly neat because all of our wood stacked is actually a family Saturday morning activity. So the kids stacked all the wood this year for their Saturday jobs.
Oh, that's brilliant. All right, Marilyn, time to talk about some of the products you have there at Silloway. In addition to the traditional syrup, one thing I love is bourbon barrel-aged syrup. So when did you start making this?
So I think we started making bourbon barrel aged syrup about 3 years ago. We take a barrel that has previously been used to age bourbon and fill it with hot maple syrup, and then we leave it set about 8 months, and then hot pack it in bottles. And we have had just such a positive response from the public about that. Everyone loves it.
Where do you get your barrels from?
So we have a gentleman that sugars here locally, and we source them through him. He's gotten them, you know, mostly from Kentucky, but he sources them sometimes different places from small distilleries.
Now, I know you probably have grown up as a purist and just want, you know, pure maple syrup, but have you come around? I mean, do you partake in the bourbon barrel aged?
Absolutely. We also have several other infused syrups that we do, you know, cinnamon, vanilla, habanero, ginger. We've added that one, vanilla, coffee. And yes, at first, you're exactly right. I am a purist, and I was quite skeptical. But when my mother came up for the with the idea of the cinnamon maple syrup, was actually our first. Mm. And it's just we put the hot syrup in a bottle, add a cinnamon stick, cap it, and there's your cinnamon infused maple syrup. Nothing else added. And I love it. I love all of them. And I never thought I would say that, but I'm a big fan of every flavor we have.
Oh, beautiful. I think the perfect Vermont dessert is Stratford Organic, their cinnamon ice cream with some bourbon barrel-aged pure Vermont maple syrup on top. It is the best Vermont dessert you can possibly have. Open to discussion. I'm sure the apple pie people will argue with me and others, but I love it so much. Betty, for the kids, are you doing sugar on snow?
Yeah, we do sugar on snow. We had a great group of students from Dartmouth College here the other day, and we did sugar on snow, and we have maple creamies as well, so they had those. I'm advertising sugar on snow free for our open house, and looking out the window from our sugar house store as I talk to you, we have very little snow left this morning.
Oh, right.
And we'll see if we have any for open house or not.
And when is that?
There are two weekends this year, March 19th and 20th, and March 26th and 27th.
All right.
But, you know, if we don't have sugar on snow, we'll have some free cotton candy with maple in it. And we also have a really neat sugar on snow sundae. We make with our maple creamy, then I boil down syrup, and we serve that on the creamy. And it makes it kind of taffy that sugar on snow does. And then you get a donut and a pickle and so on. So we will improvise, as Vermonters do, if we have no snow.
Yeah, I mean, doing that beautiful taffy on the creamy is not going to be bad at all. As a matter of fact, that's like turning
it
up
not
a notch.
Bad.
Do you also boil hot dogs in the syrup?
Well, you know, traditionally, long, long, long ago, sugar makers put the hot dogs right in their front pan, or hard-boiled eggs, you know, right in the syrup that they were going to make. And, of course, that's not acceptable. But I do always have a big pan of sweetened, you know, sweeter than sap, less sweet than syrup. And we boil the hot dogs and serve them, and they're delicious.
Oh,
but
I
not
bet.
In the front pan.
I gotcha. Okay. Not in the front pan.
No, and when we have sugar on snow, we no longer have it like they do in Quebec with the long trough full of snow, which is so picturesque, and you're eating beside your neighbor. I think if people never were skeptical before COVID, we'll probably never get back to that. So you each get an individual tray.
Yeah. Which is the way I've had it, and it's fine. It's a great way to enjoy it. Coming from away and, you know, getting to try sugar on snow for the first time, what an absolute treat. I know there's some people who wonder, what, the donut, the pickle? You got to do the whole thing.
You got to do the whole thing. It's best if you can get a homemade raised donut. My other daughter, Rebecca, is a specialist at those, and not all the public gets to have one because she does not make that many. But, boy, when she comes down the driveway with a big brown grocery bag for the family, that's high living.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. All right. Michelle, something else to – I'm sorry, Marilyn, something else to really tuck into that I can't wait is the maple cream. Describe maple cream.
Yes. Are you talking about the maple cream or our maple creamy?
Cream.
Just to clarify.
Cream.
Maple cream. Okay, because yep. We get that all the time. So our maple cream is just this beautiful, pure maple spread that we make by cooking syrup down to a softball stage, which is about 233 degrees. And then we have a system to cool it carefully to room temperature. And then we stir it. I grew up doing that in a pot with my grandma in her kitchen and a wooden spoon. We now have a machine that stirs it for us. But it just turns that, you know, taffy syrup into this beautiful, creamy, light, golden spread that is just delightful on, you know, those raised donuts my mom was talking about. As a frosting for cookies, I like it the best with just some walnuts dipped in it from time to time as a special treat. But it's really a delightful product that most people are just thrilled to be introduced to.
Well, one thing your website has is a ton of great maple recipes. And there is one that looks like it's perfect for the maple cream, and that's the Doughboy. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I guess I haven't, I'm not sure about the Doughboy recipe on the website. My mother put that on there.
Betty?
She might have to speak to that one.
Well, usually at a campfire, my daughter Rebecca has 5 boys, and as you can imagine, bonfires are prevalent, and she often makes a batch of biscuit dough, and then the boys can roll it around their stick and roast it on the fire and then spread it with maple cream, and that, again, is high living.
I love it. You know, Betty, one thing you've done is written a book. It's a farm wife's journal. Tell us about that.
Well, writing it was easier than living it, I'll tell you that. It was a section of our farm life when we had only 3 children. Now I have 6, but just the daily life, almost blow by blow or minute by minute, that I wish everyone could read, not because it's my book, but because most people don't have the benefit of ever knowing what's behind the scenes when they buy a gallon of milk or a gallon of maple syrup. I had the privilege of living that life, which is not common nowadays.
Yeah. Marilyn, we got to talk about one more product. You have maple rub, and this sounds like the most brilliant thing. I don't think I've seen anybody else do this. Tell us about that.
Well, our maple rub is a base of our maple sugar, which I make myself, which is honestly one of my very favorite products as well. Mm-hmm. But we have, so it's the base of maple sugar, and then we just add a variety of other spices in it. And it's, you know, we call it a maple meat rub, and it's just amazing on, you know, chicken and salmon and anything, really. But it's also delightful on popcorn, and we've just found, you know, sprinkled on top of shepherd's pie, mashed potatoes, we've just found a myriad of uses for it, and it is probably one of our best-selling products.
Boy, I bet you could toss some vegetables in that and roast them, and they'd be outstanding as well.
That as well. I've done that as well, and it's just so good. Great idea.
I know how to eat. All right, we've got about a minute left. Betty, tell us what it's like, you know, days and nights when the sap gets going, when you start boiling like mad there at Silloway.
Well, Marilyn does at least half of our boiling, and then we have a fellow who comes in and does some too, but I would say probably it's amazing for a mother to watch her family work. Probably Paul sleeps 10 minutes at a time during the season. Those guys are chasing down leaks and calling SAF, and, you know, they've got a neat system here where they can watch the vacuum level on some of the lines right from the sugar house or on their smartphones. And well, 1 year we had a bear go through, and in a matter of minutes you can see who's chewing way out there somewhere, and they've got to go out there with a headlamp. He says they didn't take a gun. I don't really know. But anyway, just to watch the amazing effort that goes into 4 or 5 weeks a year of production is just amazing.
Outstanding. Listeners, to learn more about the operation at Silloway Maple, the maple products that they offer, you can visit SillowayMaple.com. Betty and Marilyn Lambert, it has been a joy. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to start getting seriously prepped for growing season when we visit High Mowing Organic Seeds. And coming up today at 4 o'clock, we've got the afternoon news service with Brady Farkas, followed by the Brady Farkas Show, and then jazz with George Thomas at 7. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Hello, this is Stephen Tanzi, and I'm interrupting the podcast real quick to explain that we had some technical difficulties on site while this podcast was being recorded, and therefore we do not have some of the audio for this podcast. I'm going to be bringing you into the last interview Rick did during this show. The topic was high mowing organic seeds, and he spoke with Tom Stearns in Wolcott. I know it's going to be a little jarring, but here we go.
These are for home gardeners mostly. So, like, for people who are beginning home gardeners, they might not know where to begin. So there's, like, a garden starter collection that has, like, 8 or 10 different varieties of basic vegetables that are varieties that are kind of bulletproof, you know? Some varieties are a little more finicky. It's worth the reward, but you might need to be a little more experienced gardener to pull it off. But those have bulletproof varieties in them. Or there's a culinary herbs collection or a sunflower collection. Sometimes people want those as gifts also, or that sort of thing.
Yeah, those are neat. What would you say is the most exotic or rare seeds that you sell?
It's a good question. We have found some old heirloom varieties and kind of brought them back. And some of these varieties have just fascinating stories to them, and we might not sell a huge amount of them, but we might be the only company that is selling them, and so they're rare in that way. And, you know, agriculture has really changed a lot over the years. People don't grow the same kinds of plants anymore. People don't grow a lot of their own food anymore, or people, maybe they get their staples from the grocery store or market, but they'll grow a little bit of this or a little that at home. But people don't grow grain at home anymore in their garden. And so, you know, certain things like a flint corn that used to be much more commonly grown as a staple for people, even just having a little quarter acre of it, is not done much anymore. So we have a few varieties like that that are from, you know, another era, but have a lot of merit to them, I think, today.
Who are your customers for high mowing organic seeds, and where do your seeds get distributed?
Different types of customers. We have a lot of home garden customers, and again, some of those might be something like even a tiny little window box or a community garden plot or a rooftop, all the way to someone who has a pretty substantial home garden growing most of their own food. Small farmers, people who are doing 5, 10, 20 acres of vegetables and a couple greenhouses. I mean, certainly much bigger operations. We have people buying seed from us who do hundreds and hundreds of acres of vegetables. stores, Aubuchon's, Gardener Supply, Guy's Farm and Yard, basically all little greenhouses and garden centers and places like that carry our seeds in the displays. This might be how people are most familiar with seeing us. Mm-hmm. But those displays and the stores there for home gardeners, that's, you know, maybe about 20% of the business. The bulk is just small farmers all around the country and Canada.
Yeah. We're discussing seeds with High Mowing's Tom Stearns. Listeners, you can add your thoughts at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. It's been 26 years since Tom Stearns started growing and selling organic seeds. Now gardeners from around the world can't wait for the annual catalog so they can order the 100% organic non-GMO seeds from High Mowing Organic Seeds in Woolkit. Tom Stearns is with me for a few more minutes, and if you'd like to speak with him, our numbers are 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Did I get that right, Tom? Do you still send out the seed catalogs, or is everything online now?
No, we send out seed catalogs for sure. I mean, it is a baked-in tradition that is a couple centuries old for people. You know, the very first mail order anything in the world was seeds.
Oh, no kidding.
So, yeah. In fact, the postage stamp weight was based on a packet of seeds. Originally.
Oh, I love that idea. Well, here's a city boy question, and I'm a city boy. How do you get seeds? How do you harvest seeds from, you know, 700 different plants?
Okay, so think about the seeds that you encounter in normal cooking in the kitchen, right? Like let's use tomato as an example. You slice the tomato, they're the seeds. So with a fruit, you know, tomato is officially a fruit. Anything that has seeds in it is counts as a fruit. So, the tomato, when it's green, it's not very sweet. It doesn't have a lot of sugars. Yes, you can have your fried green tomatoes, but it is not like the highest form of the tomato.
Right.
It's not fully mature or ripe. So, when you're growing for seed, you need to wait until the fruit itself is really ripe. And so tomatoes, it's the same thing. The same stage that you have them for eating is when they're ready for seed as well. So now if you're doing it at home, you know, you chop your tomato in half, you squeeze the juice and seeds out, you rinse them off. In the case of tomatoes, you need to kind of let them soak for a day or two because there's that little slimy gel on the seed.
Right.
And soaking kind of ferments it and gets rid of that. And at a bigger scale, you do that too. It's just with different equipment. But yeah, and then you just rinse and dry the seeds and you got them. So tomatoes, super easy. Something like lettuce, you know, a head of lettuce, those are just leaves. There's no seed. There's no like flowering or fruiting part in the lettuce that we eat.
Right.
But if you've ever had a head of lettuce in your garden, not get harvested and start to bolt, it's called bolting, that's when it starts forming a flower head and a seed, and a lettuce plant will get to be like 3 or 4 feet tall, even taller. And we'll have all these yellow flowers on the top. And around here, it's pretty tricky because the flowers can often bolt because the rain gets in them and everything.
Mm-hmm.
They're more of an arid climate crop for seed, that is. But you can get some seed, and it's just the plant changes form completely. You know, normally lettuce is like 2 months and you have lettuce to eat. But for seed, it takes like 6 or 7 months. And like I said, it's 3 or 4 feet tall. So tomatoes, basically the same. Lettuce, totally different, completely different form, completely different life cycle.
Wow. It seems like a real time intensive project, you know, to undertake for each individual plant. But you still seem very passionate about this, Tom. Why is this important to you to have a place where people can be 100% sure about the seeds they plant in their garden or in their farm?
Well, I mean, like I was saying earlier, you know, the earth is not doing so great under our stewardship right now. I mean, it's pretty rough out there. Somehow we have gotten so disconnected from the environment that we live in that most of our actions are destroying our actual planet, and we just continue to do it. That's messed up. That's like really disconnected. So gardening and growing some of your own food, farming, being connected to the soil beneath your feet, your little environment, is a way to help resensitize ourselves to the fact that we are these humans on this planet and depending upon it. And so finding the right seeds and offering the right seeds for a new kind of agriculture, an organic agriculture, a sustainable agriculture that is really leaving this place better than we find it, I think is one of the single most important things that we can be doing. And so, you know, our seeds, we're a small company, but our seeds go out to hundreds of thousands of places and tens of thousands of communities every year, and hopefully can spark that hope, as well as the inspiration and the actual tool itself for growing food in a different way and reconnecting to this planet and nature in a different way.
Tom, what's a variety of high-mowing seeds that you wish people would try more because you think they'd be outrageously surprised by the vegetables that they grow?
Well, I'm a big fan of winter squash, actually. And there's some winter squash varieties that we have. One that I would describe is called Brulee. And just like a creme brulee, it is incredibly sweet and nutty and delicious. Mm. It is a miniature butternut. So, you know, people might be used to a big Waltham butternut or the larger butternuts that are like 8 inches long and weigh like 3, 4, or 5 pounds.
Right.
Well, this little thing weighs in at about a pound each. It's, you know, productive in small spaces, so it would be helpful for, you know, smaller gardeners also. It stores really well. So around here, you know, we have a shorter growing season, so growing things that we can then store in our basement or cupboard or, you know, in a cool, dry place in our home really helps extend the season. So Brulee, really tasty, really sweet butternut, has a lot of disease resistances. For around here, that's really important. Good in small spaces, good for storing. This is a good one.
You've convinced me. We have about a minute and a half, Tom, but high mowing has always been very socially responsible as a business. What are some of the things that the company does to give back?
Well, yeah, we try. I mean, I always feel like there's so much more that we could do, and we will over time. We've donated food from our fields. From the beginning, tens of thousands of pounds every year goes to the food bank, either directly or through Salvation Farms that does gleaning in our fields. That's something really important. With our team, with our staff of about 70 people, we really invite them to bring their whole selves to work and recognize that we don't want them to leave. We want to welcome all the skills, the curiosities that people have, and provide opportunities for people to grow and to be authentic at work and in their communities at home. And that is something that is maybe a little bit of a different twist on your question of social responsibility, but it's pretty important in my mind. Pretty important.
Tom Stearns is the owner of High Mowing Organic Seeds in Wolcott. The website address is highmowingseeds.com. Tom, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, take care. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, and you can feel free to suggest topics or guests by emailing us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. That's going to be followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference right after CBS News in the noon hour. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.